her only TV interview, former Blue Origin employee Alexandra Abrams tells Lori Siegel of 60 Minutes Plus she believes the company sacrificed safety because Bezos wanted to win the space race.
That was Mike Wacker, the Google engineer who first spoke out right here to us. Oh, what do you know? Hours after that, he was suspended and then fired.
Now, Dr. Timnit Gebru, a former Google employee and expert in artificial intelligence who spoke out against AI bias, has been calling for stronger whistleblower protection.
Last year, a former data consultant at Cambridge Analytica blew the whistle on his firm for illegally harvesting and exploiting the information of millions of Facebook users.
British lawmakers are right now hearing from yet another Facebook whistleblower, a former data scientist. Sophie Zhang is her name.
Her name is Frances Haugen. That is a fact that Facebook has been anxious to know since last month when an anonymous former employee filed complaints with federal law enforcement.
As the power of big tech has grown, so has the number of whistleblowers. Well, Facebook is the latest company in the line of fire after whistleblower Frances Haugen's congressional testimony earlier this month. Haugen accused the company of spreading disinformation for profit and fomenting a toxic environment. Apple is also facing an internal crisis. One of the organizers of the Apple II movement was fired last week. More than 500 employees say they've faced racial and gender-based discrimination at that company. Well, many tech companies have had whistleblowers, but blowing the whistle is complicated and risky. What does it take to be a whistleblower, and has it and could it lead to change in Silicon Valley? This is the 1A Podcast. I'm David Gura in for Jen White. Remember, to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. We'll be back in just a moment.
This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Wyzant. Need a smarter way to learn anything? Wyzant is the nation's biggest network of professional tutors, connecting you with experts in more than 12,000 topics for personalized one-on-one lessons. On Wyzant, you choose how much to pay, who you work with, and when you meet, in person or online. NPR listeners can experience the difference personalized tutoring makes this back-to-school season by taking $25 off each of your first three lessons. Head to wyzant.com/NPR today to start learning.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing whistleblowers in Silicon Valley. Joining us is Ifeoma Ozoma. She is a former Pinterest employee, creator of the Tech Worker Handbook on Whistleblowing. She's also co-sponsor of the Silenced No More Act. That's a bill that California Governor Gavin Newsom signed earlier this month, designed to help protect whistleblowers in California. Ifeoma, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And Meredith Whitaker is a faculty director of the AI Now Institute at New York University. She's a former Google employee. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with you. I'd love to get your reaction to what we saw on Capitol Hill now a few weeks ago. Frances Haugen testifying before a congressional committee on the heels of this interview with 60 Minutes. Did anything about that, both the testimony and the presentation, the introduction of her to the American people, indeed to everyone, surprise you?
It wasn't surprising, but it was encouraging. As you said in the intro, whistleblowing isn't new, and whistleblowing on Facebook specifically and on consumer harms isn't new. But what was encouraging was the corroboration of the information that we've received from experts who have been looking into hate speech and harms to teenagers and all of the other things that Facebook has been responsible for years.
Let me ask you about the rollout, the way that it all played out, the anticipation that there was going to be a whistleblower testifying. Her name was kept secret leading up to just right before the hearing. There was the release on 60 Minutes. How much of a playbook is there for someone who is intending to blow the whistle in this way, utilizing both the media, congressional committees perhaps, and then filing the formal whistleblower complaint?
There isn't a playbook because everyone's situation is specific to them. The reason why I created the Tech Worker Handbook, along with the partners I worked with, was that it's such an intensely personal decision to decide to lose your job and your health insurance and any prospects of working in the industry going forward to speak up in the public interest. And so for some people like Francis, working with a professional PR team is the right decision for them. And I'm glad that those supports exist. But for many others, speaking up in their own words, on their own time, doing it in a way that's much quieter is also right for them. And I think everyone has to figure out what makes sense and what's safe for them personally and for their families, because we also have to remember these tech companies have a history of going after people.
Meredith, what was going through your mind as you watched that testimony, knowing as you do the difficulty of doing so, of the protections that are in place within these companies, the barriers that are in place that make it difficult for somebody to speak out?
Yeah, I think I was listening closely to the content of the testimony. I agree with Ifoma here that, you know, what we were seeing was not particularly surprising, but what it did bring to light so clearly was the fact that Facebook knew about these harms that researchers and organizers and, you know, folks inside the company had named before. We have conclusive evidence that they knew, and they chose not to act. They chose profits and business as usual over remedying these harms. So I think that was a profound contribution to the public discourse and to the efforts that many of us are engaged in to try to hold these companies accountable and try to implement forms of democratic governance over technologies that right now have so much unchecked power over our lives and institutions.
I want to go back to when you were at Pinterest and weighing becoming a whistleblower. You were on the public policy team there. What did you want to, indeed, what did you speak up against when you were there?
Well, when I was there, I was doing my job leading our work and the industry's work on addressing vaccine misinformation and other forms of health misinformation, while I was also quietly battling the company and the team I sat on, the legal team, over pay discrimination and retaliation that I faced after I raised complaints with California's version of the EEOC, the state's Department of Fair Employment and Housing. So I was living a double life. And then when I was pushed out at the beginning of the pandemic and was stripped of my health insurance and any additional compensation that I had earned and that I should have received after working there, particularly before the company went public, I decided to speak up shortly after the company issued a statement saying that they believed that Black lives and Black employees' lives specifically mattered. That just struck me as so hypocritical, because I know the people on the comms team and on the legal team who were retaliating against me and who would have been the very same ones who drafted that statement.
Big tech is part of the lexicon now, and I think maybe what's lost is how large these companies are, and you are one component part of a really large enterprise. How much was that influencing your decision to speak up, just understanding that dynamic, how mammoth the company is compared to you as one person, one employee of the company?
It was huge, and I thought of myself as an employee or worker in a smaller tech company, because before Pinterest, I was at Facebook, and before Facebook, I was at Google, on the public policy teams at all three. And so I understand intimately how communications work at these companies, how the role of the folks on the policy teams work, and then how the legal team works with all of the company to ensure that only what the company's leadership wants is what's shared.
I'm going to read a statement that we got from Pinterest, and then I'll have you respond again, bringing your witness to bear what you've seen and what you've seen since you've left, but a spokesperson for that company said, in the past year, we've taken a number of steps, including achieving equal pay for comparable work, providing employees with transparency as how they're paid in compensation with their peers, and requiring all employees to undergo recently revamped unconscious bias training. Have you noticed a difference since you left? Again, you're now looking at it from the outside. You made this decision to become a whistleblower. Did change happen as a result of that? Were you able to affect change to the degree that you wanted to?
100%. The listeners can't see my face, but I was laughing while you read this statement, because yeah, they now have pay transparency and pay equity after they claimed that the complaints that I raised were bogus. So it's really interesting that now things have changed. As we all know, things don't just change on their own. When I first spoke up last summer, they all but called me a liar. And they claimed that nothing that I had brought up while I was at the company or that I brought up to the state was legitimate. But so many changes have now taken place over the last year. One of the funniest things to me was the very same day that the New York Times published an op-ed that I wrote encouraging the California Senate to move the Silence No More Act through the first part of the legislative process. The CEO of Pinterest a few hours later then sent an email to the whole company saying that he and the company supported the legislation. So I am very glad that from my pain, there's been progress and progress at the scale of legislation for 40 million people, but it shouldn't take any individual losing their job, losing their health insurance, and losing the career that they were really proud of in order to affect this change.
Meredith Whitaker, has the dynamic changed as you've seen it now with your remove from Silicon Valley, from Google and Silicon Valley more broadly? Do you see that there have been sea change moments? Do you think that the dynamic has changed between employers and their employees?
Absolutely. I think, 5 years ago or so, and this is something, Ifoma and I have discussed, it was, you would mention to your colleagues that, maybe we should organize, maybe we should push back, maybe we should unionize, maybe there are significant problems at this company that aren't going to be solved by a debate club sort of contest of ideas, right? And it was, it was seen as almost laughable that we would have a labor movement in tech, that we would have a movement of whistleblowers, creating sort of the conditions of transparency that we need to govern these companies. And that shifted profoundly in the last 5 years. And I think that's thanks to a lot of workers who began to realize, the significant contradictions between what these companies said, these sort of, as Ifoma was talking about, the Black Lives Matter platitudes versus, the treatment of Black workers inside these companies. So the difference between what these companies said and, how they behave, both in terms of their business decisions, the effect of Facebook on democracy or building AI weapons for the Pentagon, what have you, and in terms of their workplace conditions.
We'll be back with our conversation on whistleblowers in Silicon Valley in just a moment. A reminder to have your questions answered on future topics, or to just let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Best Fiends. When it comes to match 3 style puzzle games, only one reigns supreme, Best Fiends. It's an action-packed adventure game and puzzle game rolled into one, so it's no wonder it's got so many 5-star reviews. Plus, there's new content added all the time. If you're tired of crushing the same old candy, give Best Fiends a try. You can download Best Fiends free on the App Store or Google Play Store. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing whistleblowers in Silicon Valley. If I might want to ask you a bit more about the Tech Worker Handbook, and you go to the site, it's described as a living document. It's something that's going to be updated. And I was immediately struck by a description of the calculus that a prospective whistleblower would have to go to. And there is a moment when that individual has to recognize that there could be a lot of blowback. There could be ramifications to that individual's personal life, obviously to his or her employability. Walk us through sort of the calculus that someone undertakes when this comes up, when this is a decision point.
The Tech Worker Handbook was created because there isn't one set path. I say on the homepage that it's not a how-to, it's not even a call to action to whistleblow, because for me, it's as much a success as a resource. If someone reads through all of it, creates a plan, works out their budget for whether they can afford to, and realizes they can't and decides not to. It is really important that anyone who decides to make this decision understands that they're going up against a billion or trillion dollar corporation. There is no leveling the playing field. There's no winning in the end. There are wins, but you're not going to battle against a Goliath and coming out victorious. Someone is going to get bruised, and it's usually the individual who's taking these risks. So I wanted to make sure that people understand what all of the legal implications were, how to even find a lawyer. Many of the tech workers who have reached out to me in the year plus since I whistleblew have asked me how to retain a lawyer. They've never spoken to individuals about retaining counsel. A lot of folks don't know how to talk to reporters. They don't understand what it means to go on the record or be on background. And that's really important when your name ends up in a large publication and all of a sudden you have family members who are being reached out to by private investigators or by trolls. So I just wanted to make sure that folks understood all of the different things that they should be considering. And then when they make that decision, they feel really confident about it.
We got a voicemail from Bridget in Tucson, Arizona, about what happens after whistleblowers go public. Let's take a listen to that.
One question I have is how they might be able to get jobs after coming forward at their, you know, previous company, especially a company so big like Facebook. I'm just wondering how folks survive after, you know, being a whistleblower and, you know, technically, I guess, breaking that company trust. Just how do they take care of themselves afterward?
Meredith, I'll put that question to you, and if maybe you can jump in afterward as well. But how big of an issue is this, just finding a way to be employed once again after becoming a whistleblower?
Yeah, well, you know, very few people work without needing the money. So that's a big issue. And in the U.S. especially, we have a system in which our health insurance and so many of the survival resources we need to, you know, be individuals in this world that are, you know, healthy are tied to employment. So it is it's a huge issue. And then in the tech industry, we know there are blacklists. We know that, you know, once you come forward for whistleblowing or in any oppositional sort of stance toward your employer, that it's very likely you'll be blacklisted or, you know, have a hard time getting another job in the industry. So this is a big consideration. And again, I think this is what's so valuable about IFOMA's handbook, is that it walks you through these, right? It's not a Pollyanna kind of document that's encouraging everyone to just run out on the streets and whistleblowing. It's really helping people weigh the risks and recognize that not everyone is going to be in a position to take those risks. And this is where, you know, having networks of solidarity, having organization within, you know, workers at these companies is really important, because then you can begin to have a discussion with similarly concerned workers within big tech about who can take these risks, right? Should we go public as individuals or not? Because we also need to remember that whistleblowing is not synonymous with coming forward personally, that a lot of what we know about tech is, you know, about the harms of tech is thanks on one hand to whistleblowers, whether they're anonymous or not, and many of them are, and to investigative journalists who've used Freedom of Information Act and other sources to cobble together an understanding of what tech is actually doing that does not match the marketing materials and the hype coming out of these companies. And that is hugely valuable in our efforts to govern and to rein in the power of these companies. So I think, you know, I think that's a huge issue, and that's why we need to take this seriously, right? And why we need to take seriously the risks that people took and make sure there are paths where people of conscience can be employed and can find a livelihood outside of these companies and outside of the type of, you know, punishing blacklist that they might implement.
Meredith, I want to ask you about a dynamic that's emerged here, that New York Times recently reported that Facebook has significantly limited the number of people who have access to internal messaging boards and other forums. This happened shortly after Frances Haugen's congressional testimony. These companies are notoriously tight-lipped. It's a difficult relationship between them and the press and the public generally. And I wonder just sort of like how this surge in whistleblowing, how we have more whistleblowers coming forward. The other side of that coin is you've seen companies kind of clamp down, and I wonder how you see that resolving itself.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not clairvoyant, but I think it's pretty, you know, it makes a lot of sense that companies that are not, you know, prioritizing public good will also be locking down information about, you know, their potential public bad. We saw a similar dynamic at Google, and it served two purposes, right? They started locking down documents. They started putting in place policies that would penalize people for accessing documents that they weren't supposed to access, even if they didn't know they weren't supposed to access it. So they were putting in place policies that, one, would chill a lot of people's curiosity or willingness to look at this information, which would reduce the number of people who knew about it. They hoped, although I'm skeptical whether this really works, especially given so much documented harm at this point. But they also, importantly, these policies create a pretext by which they can target people that they want to get rid of, right? And I think it's important to recognize that all of the documents of these companies, these are all electronic documents, right? So if I click on a document, I'm going to a link, it's hitting a server, and the company is the one that has the logs, the information about whether or not I access that, right? I don't have that information, right? So it's very easy when you have these policies in place to then make claims that, Meredith, the troublemaker, was looking at, documents she shouldn't have been looking at. I can say, no, I wasn't, right? But, ultimately, who is the arbiter there, right? And we've seen this tactic used to fire a number of organizers at Google around Thanksgiving 2019. We've seen this tactic used to fire others. I think this is the pretext that they're using to fire some of the Apple organizers. So I think we need to be really attentive to, what this is providing for the company, and to recognize that, this is one of the favorite proscriptions, one of the favorite pieces of advice that anti-union firms and firms that are hired to break up worker organizing, to chill whistleblowing, and to protect the company so they can continue to do these harms without workers speaking out, will advise companies to do.
I want to ask both of you just about the framework for a larger conversation here. This is part of a conversation about the relationship between Washington and Silicon Valley, which is tenuous and much, much debated. But I wonder how well-equipped the regulatory apparatus is to deal with all of this, including whistleblower complaints. I go back to that piece that was in The Atlantic a couple of weeks ago calling Facebook the world's, a world autocracy, that it's not a company in a conventional sense. And if I'll turn to you on that first, just, you have a whistleblower coming forward saying good faith to bring this information to regulators. How much confidence should that individual have at this point that the apparatus is going to do what it needs to do to weigh the claims put forward in that whistleblower complaint and to take action based upon them?
At the federal level, unfortunately, next to none. I think the purpose of the transparency is to lead eventually to accountability, but currently there isn't that mechanism for accountability at the federal level. As an individual, while you're trying to navigate paying for your COBRA and figuring out your insurance and finding a job, you're supposed to also take on the burden of reaching out separately to the FTC, to your members of Congress, to the SEC, and you're meant to navigate all of that while paying a lawyer with the income you no longer have. That is not a sustainable situation, and it's not tenable for most folks, and certainly not for lower income workers who are facing a lot of the abuses that we should be focusing on as part of any conversation like this.
Meredith, I'll ask you the same question. And I'll note also that in this circumstance, Frances Haugen's circumstance, the media played an incredibly important role here. This was a huge series in the Wall Street Journal based upon the information that she provided. I think that altered the conversation on Capitol Hill, shaped the conversation on Capitol Hill among those who oversee these companies in some capacity. How about the regulators? Do you think that they have the strength and the ability to, A, take these claims seriously and B, act on them if needed?
Well, I think there are regulatory bodies that have the tools that could be applied to check these companies. But I think we need to get a bit real politic about this and realize that these companies are now spending more than big oil and big tobacco on lobbying, and that a lot of their efforts right now are directed at specifically integrating big tech into the U.S. military industrial complex, which will make it harder to regulate them because you'll have arguments that they are, so important to national security or so important to our national infrastructure that you can't actually reduce their size or reduce their power. So we're seeing, an onslaught from the tech companies right now that are happening both in overt ways with lobbyists sort of pushing back against regulation or proposing regulation that they think they can stomach and they hope will sort of satisfy the public appetite, but not actually sort of check their power in any meaningful way. I think this speaks to the need for public pushback and for workers' movements and social movements that can demand change that will effectively make it more uncomfortable for regulators not to act meaningfully than it will to act meaningfully. But I think we need to recognize, you know, we're up against, you know, massively well-resourced corporations, trillion-dollar companies with sort of armies of lobbyists that are deployed all the time to try to prevent exactly what the public and what whistleblowers and what workers have been demanding.
You know, you worked on organizing. You said there's kind of a close relationship between organizing and whistleblowing, Meredith, and I wonder just sort of what you see the status of that in Silicon Valley is. I know that there was talk about unionizing campaign, bringing that to tech in a way that we really haven't seen yet. How much has that evolved since you've left the company, and how much of an appetite is there, do you think, in Silicon Valley for that kind of formal organizing?
Yeah, I mean, I would push back a little and say we're actually seeing it happening, right? You know, I think there's a union at Google, there's a union at Kickstarter. We're seeing unionization efforts across the industry, and it's happening extremely rapidly, right? Again, like 5 years ago, you would get like, there would be just a number of libertarian men at your lunch table who would like laugh at you if you mentioned the union. And now, you know, if you talk to them, they've always believed in the union. They're just going to argue about which kind, right? So there's been a huge cultural shift among the workers and I think in tech generally, recognizing workers as having solidarity with each other and not necessarily sharing the interests of the board or the, you know, the executives at these companies. You know, a lot of people just don't want to be involved in the scale of harms that they're seeing perpetuated by these companies, and they want a way to push back. And a union is a classic way for workers to gain back some of the power in the employment relationship.
Let me take the Facebook whistleblower as an example here as we wrap up in the couple of minutes that we have left. So Frances Haugen has testified before Congress. She's also testified, I believe, before European Parliament as well. She continues to carry that mantle, which I imagine is an incredible weight for a whistleblower to continue. Where do you see that case going? You know, it made this very sizable splash, created a lot of interest at the very beginning. How does a whistleblower sustain interest in the case and keep regulators engaged and interested with what's been brought forward?
I think that attention is really important, but attention isn't change. And so what we really need is folks to reach out to their state lawmakers and to push for legislation to be drafted and introduced at the beginning of the next session. That's what we also need at the federal level. The hearing, I think, was incredible. But what I also was thinking about was how many of those lawmakers who are asking tough questions about Facebook receive checks from Facebook for every single one of their campaigns. Until we have actual legislation that we can look at the federal level that would rein in these companies and the power that they have and address what we're discussing, the discussions are just that, discussions.
Meredith, how has this last year, these last 18 months, changed the culture of big tech? I mean, having people working remotely, I imagine that's exacerbated probably many of these workplace issues, has changed them at least, we can say. What kind of effect has that had on the workplace culture, do you think, within tech?
Well, I haven't been inside tech since July 2019, so I can't speak from experience. I do think we've seen a sea change over the last 18 months, and I would mark, you know, one event that I think was really important in kind of moving this conversation forward, and that was Google's treatment of Tinit Gebru. And I think that, you know, that combines the type of discrimination and racism and retaliation that is endemic at these companies with an explicit effort by the company to suppress and degrade research and information that it found challenging. So, you know, Tinit was the lead of one of the co-lead of the ethical AI group, had written a paper that critiqued some of Google's very profitable technologies. Mm-hmm. And Google tried to suppress this paper and ultimately fired her. So I think that was a moment where the kind of people saying we need to, you know, take big tech with good faith and sort of work with them, I think that really kind of, you know, cut that off a bit, or sort of, you know, made that a kind of impossible assertion, a fantastical assertion.
Meredith Whitaker is faculty director of the AI Now Institute at New York University. Ifeoma Ozoma is a former Pinterest employee and creator of the Tech Worker Handbook on whistleblowing. Thanks both of you for joining us this hour. Really appreciate it. Today's producer is Sophia Alvarez-Boyd. The program comes to you from WAMU, which is part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm David Gura. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.